And I've tried to impress upon people just how eerie and bizarre and terrifying corn becomes when it passes the plane of your eyes and you know for a certainty that there are grizzlies in there. And there can be a lot of grizzlies. Up to 16 bears had been observed at a single time feeding in that field.
On April 27th, 2019, as part of the Country Bookshelf celebration of National Independent Bookstore Day, award-winning Montana author Bryce Andrews read from his latest book, Down from the Mountain, as well as discussing his experiences as field director with People and Carnivores, an organization based in Bozeman, Montana, that works to reconnect and restore carnivore populations in the Northern Rockies by working with the region's people to prevent human-carnivore conflicts. They work with landowners and managers, tribes, community groups, and other NGOs to keep people safe, and bears, wolves, and cougars wild. Bryce Andrews is introduced by People and Carnivores Executive Director Lisa Upson.
Good afternoon, everyone, and happy Independent Bookstore Day. We are in the right place. I'm Lisa Upson. I'm the director of People and Carnivores, or People and Predators, or Humans and Big Animals with Big Teeth. And we work to prevent conflicts so that large carnivores can travel between core habitat areas such as Yellowstone and the Glacier Area and central Idaho to keep populations healthy and keep communities thriving and livelihoods thriving. So that's the work we do. Most of our work is done west of here in the High Divide and north of Missoula and in the Bitterroot Valley. And the way we work is that we partner with landowners to implement field projects, and we also create forums to help landowners learn from one another how to live with large carnivores. We used to be known as Predator Conservation Alliance. Most importantly today, People and Carnivores is fortunate to have Bryce Andrews on our team. Bryce is our field director, and so he leads all of our field projects around Missoula in the Bitterroot Valley and north of Missoula in the Flathead Reservation and the Mission Valley and so forth. But Bryce is a man of many talents. He is not just an amazing fence builder and relationship builder, he is also an award-winning author. Bryce published his first book, Bad Luck Way, in 2014. And Bad Luck Way is about living and ranching in wolf country, specifically in the Madison Valley at the Sun Ranch. So if you are inclined to buy books today on this Independent Bookstore Day, you might want to look for that one as well. Bad Luck Way, by the way, won several awards, and I want to mention just one of them, the 2014 Reading the West Book Award for Nonfiction. So it's another great book of his. Today, we're just pleased that Bryce is here in Bozeman to read from his new book, Down from the Mountain.
Well, thank you all for being here. And I just saw that my mother came in late. It's okay. She's been to another one, so it's all right. First, I want to say thank you for having me. I really want to, before I start into all of this, let you guys know how important it is to support your local bookstores. This is the kind of thing that we're doing today, you know, gathering together to talk about a piece of writing or somebody's story. It's local bookstores, independent bookstores, that make that happen. So support them today. Support them as much as you can, because they really are a resource for communities, and we're lucky to have them. I'm lucky to have them, and yeah, we all are. So, and thank you, Lisa, too, and everybody else from People and Carnivores who's here. The group is based here in Bozeman. I see. Basically our whole staff is out here, and you should know it's a tiny group. You're looking at half of the field staff right now. So really, if you can support them also, that's a great thing to do. If you enjoy hearing about some of the field work, just know that there are people doing that all the time, and that you can help them do that. So I guess without any further ado, I want to launch in here. I'm really glad to have the chance to talk with you about Down from the Mountain, because the work and the writing that led to the book consumed the last 3 years or even more of my life. And so it's a pleasure to share it with you and to try to share the place that gives rise to the story as well. So I would hope that we'll leave today with a little bit of understanding about the book, and you'll hear a couple stories, but also an understanding of how things stand today for grizzly bears and the wild landscapes upon which they depend. So Down from the Mountain takes place north of Missoula on the Flathead Indian Reservation. And though most of the story happened recently, in 2016, the tale actually begins a lot earlier, about a decade beforehand, when a single grizzly left the high peaks of the Mission Range for the valley below. And just before I start in reading, I'm going to show you a few slides today. And what you see here is the Mission Range. A couple of landmarks that are important are visible here. So you can see this mountain range up here. These are the missions. It's kind of the central heart of the missions. They're incredibly sheer and rocky and ragged. And, you know, if you were to try to climb these things, you would be very quickly humbled, even if you're in good shape. In the foreground, below the mountains, you can see a little grove of aspens. Can everybody kind of see that in the middle distance there? That's a place known as Millie's Woods, and that's one of the highest densities of grizzly bears in the lower 48 states. Crucial to the story, and we'll be talking about some other places that are visible or almost visible in this slide. So this is a good way to start getting oriented. So in 2002, in the blue light that follows dusk in late summer, she left off foraging and walked down from the foothills into a tangled aspen grove. Crossing Millie's Woods, the copse for which she'd soon be named, the bear came to a place where she could see farmstead lights spread across the floor of the Mission Valley, glittering like shards of a bottle dropped from a great height. She came in search of ripening apples and the choke cherries weighing down branches along the banks of irrigation canals, walking out of a wilderness that has remained essentially unchanged since the end of the last ice age and into an unforgiving Arcadia. The primeval valley, the fertile, deep soil that had suckered native people and grizzly bears for thousands of years, was hidden by roads, power lines, prefabricated ranch-style houses, tilled fields, and uncountable miles of barbed wire fence. She passed near Shock's Mission View Dairy, a family operation with a ramshackle milking parlor and a wide yellow Quonset barn. Nearing East Post Creek Road, she came to where the Shocks had planted their first field of silage corn, a crop that would be harvested to feed dairy cows through winter. Crossing gravel, leaving long clawed tracks in the barrow ditches, she slipped in among the stalks. Corn closed on all sides, stillness descended, and broad leaves hissed across her shoulders. Ripe ears tapped her muzzle. Sitting back on her haunches, laboring delicately with paws strong enough to break the spine of an elk, she brought an ear to her mouth and chewed. She tasted pulped kernels, husk, and silk. White gold liquid dripped from her lips. With 3-inch long claws working as precisely as forceps, she husked another ear. The corn was as endless as her hunger, and under the pale moon she gorged to the cusp of bursting. Every year a bear must solve a simple but unforgiving problem. Coming out of hibernation as thin as a rail, each grizzly must gain enough weight in the months between April and November to last through winter. From a bear's perspective, the cornfield offered a perfect solution, an infinite carbohydrate-rich source of food that ripened just as summer became fall. Having discovered the crop, the sow could no more desert it than stop breathing. There were other resources, apples, plums, and accumulations of insects high in the peaks, but nothing else was as sure or as plentiful. She frequented the field, and other bears joined her. Night after night, their numbers grew. The grizzlies toppled stalks, plucked ears, and bolted down kernels in an ecstasy of consumption. They could not have done otherwise. At the end of each summer, a bear's appetite turns desperate, insatiable. Hyperphagia is the mania's proper name, and it grips the animals tightly. The unique hunger that grows in a human stomach with the onset of cold, that ravenous demand for rich stew and potatoes, can only be a shade of what a bear feels. Theirs is a mortal compulsion to feed, exacerbated by shortening days. The sow stayed until the crop was harvested. She left the field swathed in subcutaneous fat, which kept her warm through winter. It was no wonder that she returned the following year, and that other bears did too. Cubs learned the behavior from their mothers, and adults found their way to the crop with astonishing rapidity. After the corn had been growing for a few years, up to a quarter of the Mission Valley's grizzlies were feeding in Shock's field between August and mid-September. Two things followed from this. First, Greg Shock lost a lot of corn, thousands of dollars worth, enough to threaten the solvency of his farm. Second, the grizzlies began eschewing their traditional alpine sources of late summer food. They no longer climb to the stone fields on McDonald Peak to eat colonies of army cutworm moths, or search the high forest for white bark pine nut caches laid in by red squirrels. Instead, enraptured by the corn, they stayed in the low country. This fattened the bears to the point of morbid obesity, until their teeth rotted, and they struggled to run. And it kept them near humans during their hungriest, most aggressive season. Now, I came to know Millie, this particular bear's story, because I went to work in that cornfield. I went to work there in my capacity of field director for People and Carnivores, a group that you heard a little bit about earlier today. And my job was to try to encircle that cornfield, which was about 90 acres and had a perimeter of around 2 miles, and an experimental electric fence. It was a short little fence. You can see a corner brace here. It was only about 2 feet high, but it had proved really promising in tests in the Blackfoot Valley. They had tested it on some, you know, short little enclosures and seen that bears were actually turned by this fence. The idea was to build that fence and see if it worked at a large scale, and to see whether we could stop bears from coming to this farm and engaging in this behavior that was both destructive to them and destructive to the livelihood of the farmer. So in the course of trying to build that, which I did by hand, I spent about an entire summer on the edge of that field, stretching wire, watching the corn rise up. And one thing that I would say to you is that there's a big difference between knee-high corn and head-high corn when grizzly bears are involved. I've tried this at a bunch of readings now, and I've tried to impress upon people just how eerie and bizarre and terrifying corn becomes when it passes the plane of your eyes and you know for a certainty that there are grizzlies in there. And there can be a lot of grizzlies. Up to 16 bears had been observed at a single time feeding in that field. So once that happens, corn, which seems like this really, you know, it's like this all-American, you know, pastoral thing. It's more likely that dead baseball players will come out of it than grizzly bears. So you know, like it, you look at it and you think they cannot be in there, and yet they are. I will never forget the feel of that. I'll never forget how that proximity to those animals, the constant presence of sign, the fact that there were these trails snaking everywhere. The place was saturated with bears, and that changes your perception of a place in a really critical way. It sharpens your senses. It makes you entirely present in the moment, and it wipes away so much of what defines and controls the way we react to situations in other places. So I want you to know how fundamentally strange and eerie, but interesting that was. I will never forget specifically the first time I saw the grizzly path. So there was a path beaten in from Millie's woods, that little aspen grove that you all saw, down to the edge of the cornfield. And it was like, how often do you see a footpath worn in by bears? And I was struck, one, by how many bears and how many trips it would take to make a path like that, which is sort of the terrifying part. But then I was also struck by how similar it was to something that we would make. You know, if everyone in this room started taking daily trips from here across a grassy field, we would end up with a path like that. Their feet are like our feet. You know, they have soft pads. They seek the low, soft places to walk. So you get this feeling of sort of intimate connection with the animals by seeing how they move across the landscape. Yeah, I will never forget the feeling of being there, walking near and sometimes in that corn. And being in it was a whole other thing, and a thing that, you know, everyone who loves me has said, why, God, why did you do this? And I don't have a great reason for it, except that it's such a strange thing that it almost begs to be seen. It has to be seen. Anyway, I had gotten a little bit out of order here, but the section above it that I just told you about should have ended with the phrase, my grandmother stopped praying for me if I didn't knock it off, which going in there. And I think what I would say to that is that I saw things that made the risks worthwhile. Greenlit rooms and corridors that the bears opened in the stand, impressions, one overlain on another, of pads in the field's soft mud. Leaving trail cameras out at night, I came to know several grizzlies. The subadult who circled the fence nightly, appearing first on one camera, then another. The tank of a boar who snuck in one night when the voltage dropped low. The crafty one who dug beneath the fence where it crossed a ditch. Bears, more than any other creature that walks our mountains, remind us that animals are as much individuals as our neighbors and friends, equally susceptible to whim and anger. Hikers know how some bears take offense and others let things slide. They know a grizzly chooses to ignore or engage, that bears have preferences. There was a grizzly, for example, on a ranch I managed near the edge of Yellowstone Park, who had a thing for vinyl. We called him the Naugahyde Bear, and no swatch of manufactured leather was safe while he walked the hills. If you left a four-wheeler parked in the timber while you worked, you'd come back to a missing, slobber-slick, eviscerated seat and a mess of scattered foam. Nobody knew why he liked it, but all of us who worked on the place agreed that he hunted the stuff. Of the four ATVs owned by the ranch, three had duct tape for seats. He'd done a golf cart, too, and a side-by-side John Deere Gator, if memory serves. But the Naugahyde Bear made his biggest score in early fall, when he walked brazenly in among the ranch houses and found a hot tub with an impeccable, insulated vinyl cover. It was 5 inches thick, with foam in the middle and a sumptuous grain pattern on the top. Picture him coming to it, sampling the corner with a discerning swipe, mouthing the edge, and then climbing onto the thing to indulge himself. Picture him, as I have pictured him ever since, clawing and biting, rending the cover in the consummation of his odd passion. It was more pleather than he had ever seen, or would ever again have his way with, and he made the absolute most of it. Ripping and biting, rolling, smearing the tub with bear funk, he dug through the foam. He kept on, ecstatic, until it split and plunged him into chlorinated 102-degree water. It scared the shit out of him. I know this because I cleaned the tub. And even though that mess was as bad as anything I've smelled, the whole thing seemed worthwhile. Here was a bear, I thought, even as I netted solids from the water, with definite, if unconventional, tastes. After that, I considered the Naugahyde Bear whenever I was out gathering cattle. I thought of him as I would a strange neighbor, and it enlivened the woods. Grizzlies are like that. Being dangerous, they demand our attention. And this means that we often look closely enough to see them as individuals. When a grizzly comes around, people ask, which one is it? The sow with three cubs? The old boar seen every July for a decade? We have a common inclination to know bears by their predilections, dispositions, and markings. I knew Millie, the subject of Down from the Mountain, by her damage. She was the wounded bear, distinguished by the wrecked, scarred, rotten-fleshed face that she turned to one of my motion-activated cameras one afternoon, by her slatted ribs and the painful way she turned to walk back into the corn. I knew Millie because she had been mysteriously ruined, a story that forms the backbone of this book. She made it into the corn somehow, and I could not get her off my mind. Certain things were known about her. Millie had worn a GPS collar around the year 2005, and what that meant is that we could actually see this little window for this short period of time into how she used the landscape. And I remember looking at that data after I had seen the bear in her condition. This is actually a photograph of her after she died, and we had to carry her out of the corn. It's actually a picture taken. It's a really compelling picture, but one taken for documentation. And so that's the biologist's hands and Millie's claws. But that data, that little bit of data that we had, let us see this window into her life. And what I saw when I looked at that data, she was moving across the landscape in a way that blew my mind. At different seasons, she would be up in the top of those peaks, those massive stony peaks that I showed you, eating, you know, these colonies of insects that were up there. At other times, she'd be all the way down in the valley floor, and she'd be right in among people's houses. And she lived like that, making that huge trip year to year without ever getting into trouble. And that's an amazing thing. You know, she lived among people and she didn't get into trouble. And she moved across a landscape that nobody in here could cross without a major effort, and it would be a huge undertaking. And she moved through that landscape like she could fly back and forth over the peaks. And the thing that struck me most clearly about that data, looking at it, is that it struck me as heroic. You know, it's a heroic use of the landscape. It's heroic to make your living from these tiny food sources, move across the landscape, live among people, among all these perils, unsecured garbage, you know, livestock that she could get into trouble with, chicken coops, all this stuff. And she managed it. The way she was living was heroic, and the way that she died, which, as you would learn in the book, is birdshot to the face, followed by this long, slow decline. It's tragic. It's tragic. And so I guess I knew that about her. I formed this connection with her. I saw her using the food, and I came away with this sense that there was heroism and tragedy in her life, and that her story was worth writing. Her story is worth writing because it opens onto larger issues. Her fate is sealed by the same malaises and hard realities that are working on the rest of our West. The corn that she eats in the Mission Valley, for instance, is grown from genetically modified seed and sprayed several times each year with glyphosate. A warming climate brings that crop to fruition, making it worth growing in Montana's short summer. Her life, put simply, is made first difficult and then impossible by the way we have changed this landscape and our climate. I cannot blame the farmer who grows the corn. Not entirely. He is a good man who wants to live with the bears if he can, but who is being squeezed out of business by the razor-thin margins of modern agriculture. That's the irony. Both bear and farmer are competing against forces that dwarf them. The bear against a tide of settlement and human use that each year shrinks the land available to her. The farmer against distant corporations that have driven down the cost of milk until it is impossible to make his living with 100 cows. Millie lets us see this predicament clearly. On her ruined face, the damage that we, a pronoun here used broadly and accurately, have done, shows plain as day. But this book is not only about Millie. It is about the state of things with grizzlies and wild landscapes more generally. So how do they stand? As follows. For the last several decades, the grizzly bear has been taking slow but steady steps back from the brink of extirpation in the lower 48. So we had, following the organized pursuit, hunting, and trapping of large predators in the early half of the 20th century, we had a low point in the bear population of about 700 animals in the mid-70s. And that's the point at which they were protected under the Endangered Species Act, and the point at which they began to recover. Since that time, we've been seeing this slow, steady increase in numbers of bears, and also an increase in the amount of their historical range that they occupy. So they're expanding out from these areas where they managed to survive and recolonizing places where they used to thrive. We're up to about 1,850 bears at the lowest count. It's probably more than that, but that's the low ball count in 2018. And it's important to understand that the majority of those 1,800 bears live in two populations, one around Yellowstone, the other in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem up by Glacier, and that this is a fraction of their former range, which stretch south to California, east onto the plains, and west to the Pacific. I think what I'm saying is that we are making progress, and it's good work, but it's insufficient on its own. I want to see the bears back in a larger chunk of their historic range, in places like the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness and the Central Cascades. I want them back in our last few huge, empty, wild places. Why do I want this? There are many ecological reasons, mostly boiling down to the fact that grizzlies are an essential part of a complex whole, as pistons are necessary to an engine. That's well established and proven. But I want to talk here about something more immediate, emotional, and selfish. I want to talk about what sharing the mountains with bears does for us. There is something about grizzlies that fascinates and pulls at everyone who encounters them. Half of it is their odd mix of bulk and grace. A healthy bear is a walking paradox. A heavy, seemingly ungainly creature that can turn swift and lithe in a moment. Near Yellowstone, I have seen a boar running faster than a sprinting horse can, stretching out and loping across an open meadow. Coming to a stand of brush, that bear stopped short. Losing all evidence of strength and speed, he went lumpish and shambled from sight. The phase shift was as complete and unlikely as anything I have seen, and I never forgot it. Then there are the eyes, which are not unlike ours in shape, size, and distance from each other. A bear's eyes, small in their wide heads, seem made for looking back, for focusing on and assessing us. When grizzlies are not afraid or raging, there is something tranquil, sympathetic, and even shy about their eyes. When a human meets a bear, their gazes join like halves of a split stone. A charged arc is struck between two creatures, and the rest of the world disappears in the glare. That fire is treacherous and tends toward destruction. It also contains a measure of recognition. Nobody can say what a grizzly makes of that moment, but I know what it means to me. Looking bears in the face, as an experience as consuming as falling, has given me a better grasp of what I am and how I fit into a wild, older world. I want to share these mountains with grizzlies because they remind us that human beings once lived in a community exceeding our own species. When I'm alone and I encounter a grizzly, I am always humbled by its power. When the bear does not eat me, I'm left feeling grateful. These emotions, humility, gratitude, even fear, are good things for a human to feel. And when two people encounter a bear, they depend on each other, drawing together in mutual care. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule, and I can't help but tell a story about one of them. So many years ago, I was hiking into the Madison Range, up behind the Sun Ranch, which was the place that was the subject of my first book, and I was on a date of sorts. So I was with a companion. We had just left the truck behind, and we were walking up, and we were going to spend the night at this really beautiful little lake in the backcountry. And we made it about 30 yards from the truck, maybe 50 yards from the truck, came over this rise and saw this bear, this huge, glossy, really healthy-looking bear, just lifting up like a bear does, like, ah! And just lifting up, deciding whether or not it would charge or run away or what it would do. And I was terrified, as anyone should be in that situation. And I remember sort of, you know, being really scared, but saying like, let's keep calm. Let's stay together. And at that moment, the bear kind of shifted its gaze slightly to look over my shoulder a little bit. And I looked where it was looking and saw my companion halfway back to the truck. And then I looked back and saw the bear halfway to the trees. And so I was just standing there by myself in the middle thinking like, huh, what a couple survivors, you know? Like, I guess I'm the odd man out here. And what I think I'm trying to get at with that is simply that the bears bring out a lot of our essential qualities, right? They bring us together in ways. They force us to act in the service of self-preservation. They cause us to think in a way that we don't really think and act in a way we don't really act much anymore. And they reveal our deep impulses. And that's a really good thing to have in the wilderness and on the landscape. I'm worried that our children will have fewer such encounters. Unless we make certain changes, the coming decades will see us lose habitat essential to the long-term survival of grizzlies in the West. I'm not talking about national parks and designated wilderness areas, but the privately owned habitat in between. We stand to lose our valley floors, population growth, and subdivision. It's heavy, what we've already done to this region. Ask the Salish, Kootenai, or other tribes. They've seen a complex, difficult landscape beaten into something much more convenient and commercial. I'm determined to go no farther in that direction. A few months ago, I was talking with a bear biologist with a long career behind him. It's Jamie Jonkel. Jamie's father, Chuck Jonkel, was a pioneering bear researcher. There's like a family that's like the Craigheads. You know, they've been tied to grizzly bears in this area for a long time. And here's what Jamie said. He said, "This is our last hurrah. We've got 50 years before the corridors close and grizzlies can't move between the mountain ranges. Then we won't even recognize Montana. We're like a glacier, filling up the good, low country, leaving a few mountaintops for the bears." I remain more hopeful than Jamie, but the moment's urgency is clear. If we want grizzlies to persist and thrive throughout the modern landscape and reoccupy more of their historic range, if they are to move freely between the wilderness areas essential to their long-term survival, we must act now to hold space for them. This means preserving corridors of undeveloped land between mountain ranges and defending such places against anyone crass or short-sighted enough to threaten them. It means supporting farmers and ranchers who share their land with wildlife. It means standing against subdivision and the fragmentation of important habitat. It means using dialogue, zoning, shame, and hope, whatever it takes to ensure that one generation's whim or need does not seed another generation's ruin. Seeing grizzlies thrive across a crowded West requires as much restraint as it does action. In addition to building wildlife underpasses, enacting zoning laws, and fencing cornfields, we must do something that human beings find harder. We must, whether we are platting land for subdivision or traveling a highway after dusk, slow down. And then we will have to go further, putting a machine that we have long driven forward at breakneck speed into reverse. Breaking with one of the American West's fundamental traditions, we must be the first generation to leave this place less settled, and to my way of thinking, more whole than we found it. I'll close by telling you how I mean to do this in my own life. You can hold me to it. We'll pick up the story of a bear named Baptiste, a young boar from the same population as Millie. And I'll just give you a little bit of background about Baptiste before I finish this up, because it's a story that I think really illustrates the point that I was just making about connectivity and the need to preserve these open corridors. So Baptiste was the Tribal Wildlife Agency trapped him because someone's trash was getting knocked over every night. They set up a culvert trap, which is this big steel tube, and the bear goes in, the door comes down, and they catch it. So they caught Baptiste and named him that. And they put a collar on him and let him out in the central Mission Valley. As soon as they let him out, he sprinted south. So he ran south all the way out of the Mission Valley, up over what's called the Pistol Creek Hills, which is this little mini mountain range, down into the Jocko Valley. And in the Jocko Valley, which is where Jillian, my fiance, and I now have a farm, he cut like right across the farm, shot further south, and he went all the way to this ridge. So there's a ridge above the spot where Highway 93, which is the north-south state highway that runs through the Mission Valley, intersects with Interstate 90. So the two big roads come together, and right above that, maybe a mile or so away, there's this timbered bluff. And Baptiste came screaming along, you know, he covered 20 miles in like a day and a half, popped out on there, and then he stopped in the last of the timber overlooking the Missoula Valley. And if anybody's ever stood there, as I have, what you see is that from the base of that hill, the houses begin, and they're thin at first, but they get thicker as you go toward the city. And you see the travel plazas, which have trucks coming and going, and all the traffic on the big roads. And you can't say what a bear's thinking. Nobody can. Anybody who's, if I tried to tell you what I thought Baptiste was thinking, I'd be wrong. But what I can tell you is he stood there long enough for his GPS collar to record the location twice. So he stood there for more than 4 hours. And he was in that last piece of cover. And what he was seeing out there was that the valley full of human sprawl and human occupation. And beyond that, these low timbered hills that are to the south of Missoula. And if you go through those hills, you come to the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. And the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness is contiguous with the Frank Church River of No Return. So it's the largest roadless area remaining in the lower 48. And he could see it. You know, he could look across Missoula and see it, but he couldn't get there. So Baptiste, he turned around, he came back north, he spent the rest of the summer in the Jocko Valley, which is settled with small farms generally, and stayed out of trouble and successfully denned beneath Gray Wolf Peak. But we're going to pick up his story at the bluff. I got carried away. What can you do? I cannot think of him standing there without urging him toward one of the narrow pathways remaining between the northern population of grizzlies and habitat farther to the south. Baptiste might have cut westward to where the houses thin away. Out there, he could have walked the bank of the Clark Fork River under Interstate 90 and been lost in the embracing mountains. He might have struck southeast toward the high valleys that stair-step up to Yellowstone. But he was a bear already far from home, faced with a wide lake of human bustle. Turning away from the city, Baptiste began to retrace his steps north. He spent the rest of the summer eating fruit from trees on the edge of the Jocko Valley. Though the data from his collar shows that he lived among people, and a grizzly in the Jocko is uncommon enough to be news, he was not seen or reported. Knowing how we have misused land and wildlife, I have little faith in humankind. I think it likely that we will go on wrecking the beautiful world. But I put my hope in bears of Baptiste's sort, hardy, seeking, adaptable creatures. They will find a way around or through our constructions to places that once belonged to them. Given the merest chance, they will thrive. I will do what I can to give Baptiste his chance. Well, he slept through the depths of winter. My fiance Jillian and I bought a farm on the pretty uphill edge of the Jocko. It is not as big as Shock's place, the dairy that I was talking about before, but it is a beautiful square of land with good soil, tucked tightly beside mountains. Despite the fact that it was long ago cleared for agriculture and little brush remains for cover, Baptiste visited it often in late summer. He foraged at night for apples, coming within 50 yards of the house where Jillian and I sleep. In the course of crossing fields where we will soon graze animals, he left silver-tipped fur in the barbed wire. We mean to root and make our living on that farm. We are committed. We will be stewards of the place for as long as we are able, until the land outlives us. And when we are gone, the farm will remain whole, open, and wild. It is now protected by a conservation easement, so no future owner can subdivide it. Baptiste, having visited the area and found it good, will almost certainly return to our corner of the Jocko. When he does, I will make sure that he finds no dangerous temptations. Our coops, fruit trees, and row crops will be ringed with electric fences. We will lock our garbage up tightly. We will make room for him. For every acre fenced in or plowed, we will reserve at least as much space for Baptiste and his fellows. In the farm's southeast corner, several old ponderosas mark where forest once jutted out from the foothills. We will plant seedlings, pine, fir, larch, chokecherry, nine bark, woods rose, and let them grow until the farm's uphill edge is wild again. Thank you. So this is the southeast corner of the farm, and those are the mountains in question. Are there any questions?
So there were about 1,800 grizzly bears now. What geographic region are you referring to?
It's the official count for all the populations in the lower 48. So that's what Vital Ground is actually where I got that number, and they estimate 1,000 or slightly over in the NCDE population. I think they were saying, 800 or so in the Yellowstone one. And then there's a scattering of outliers. And so that's a baseline number. That's what they're able to count and verify. So it is more than that. Yeah. Still not that many in the grand scheme. Yes.
I'm curious to know what the main causes of the death of the grizzlies are each year. Is it traffic or hunting or what?
That's a great question. Shall I repeat it? Yeah. My mother could not hear it, so I'll repeat it. The question was about the main causes of mortality to grizzlies. And we just actually came through, this is maybe a little more relevant to where I live than down here, where you're sort of in the orbit of Yellowstone. But in the Northern Continental Divide, it was the highest mortality year for grizzlies on record. We had a lot of bears die, and very few of those died because people really wanted them dead. You know, there are instances of poaching, but I think it was four or five bears out of that. Most of that comes from inadvertent things. So that would be bears that become acclimated to human food sources like garbage and small livestock and have to be put down because of that. And then what the real uptick was in vehicle collisions. We had a huge amount of bears getting whacked on the highway last year. And so it's a really interesting thing, because as more people move into this landscape and as bears begin to move out from these wild strongholds where they're really not living with us, we have this ever more acute need to solve this problem, right? Because we're going to have more people and bears mingling in the future, whether that's bears crossing highways or bears moving through subdivisions. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I work on all the time for people in carnivores. And so it looms very large in my mind, but it's something that's going to, I think, be more in the forefront for more people as bears begin to recover their population to a level where they start moving out through these landscapes. So it's all kinds of causes, mostly inadvertent. There are really some things we can do to minimize some of those, like the, you know, unsecured trash and stuff like that. Those seem like really low-hanging fruit that we can pick. Anything else? Yeah.
Your language is very precise and very beautiful. I heard an interview with you a couple weeks ago, and then when I saw you were coming, I was really excited. And it seems like your language is very non-polarizing, which I would assume working for the organization you do. But do you feel like that's been effective? I mean, because sometimes there can be such a divide.
Yeah, I feel like if I speak clearly, and if I speak compellingly, it's because there's a level of honest interest both in the future of wild things and wilderness, but an equal level of interest and care for the people who are making their living on the landscape. And I think that's, if there's one reason why I can figure out how to speak in a way that's not polarizing, it's because I come to this work, this conservation work, from a decade worth of working on and managing ranches in areas that are adjacent to wildernesses. So I understand it's such a complex thing. And I think I've had, through experience, I've had the desire to oversimplify it kind of beaten out of me, maybe. And that's helpful. I don't know if that gets at the question, but yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's important to know about this is that everybody who's living with these bears, working in the fields of conservation, agriculture in wilderness areas, or wildlife management, you know, for the state, generally speaking, they're all trying really hard and they all have really tough jobs. And I think if you go into it and grant people that, then the outcomes of conversations are generally better, hopefully.
Well, how would bears cross roads? Like tunnels or bridges or?
I mean, there are a host of structures that people use. So like right by our place, there's an overpass, which is vegetated on top. Underpasses are great. The very best things are to take advantage of places where where natural waterways and other features that bears would follow are crossed by bridges. So the group Vital Ground, which is another great group doing grizzly work, they just bought the spot where Interstate 90 crosses the Clark Fork River. just west of Missoula, which means there's this big span of a bridge and you have this kind of vegetated riparian corridor. And so structures like that, any time that the landscape breaks the road, either by going over or below it, those are good. Another thing we can do, but we seem to lack the collective will to do this, is we could slow down. You know, in areas, particularly at night, like in the Mission Valley, we had all of these collisions on a single stretch of road. And there's this big debate raging about, like, how will we solve it? It'll take millions of dollars to elevate the road and all this, and the DOT will have to be involved. I mean, we could voluntarily go 45, but nobody wants to do that. And so, I mean, that I think is the thing that I really want to get at, is like, it's tempting to think that we need a solution that does not inconvenience us at all. But what I would advocate for is that as we begin to feel the effects of the crowding of what has long been a very empty, relatively empty landscape, as we begin to feel the effects of more people wanting to be here and some of the native fauna returning to places where they haven't been for a while, we're going to have to figure out issues like this in ways that may inconvenience us. So I see that as something that may come down the line.
I'm interested in any work that you folks do getting to meet school children. I've heard hints of it, but I'd like to hear more about it.
Well, I haven't done much of that except for we do teach a course to university students. And that's a great thing. If anybody knows someone who is coming through the university right now and they want to learn about the kind of stuff we've been talking about today, which would be, you know, sustainable ranching practices and also how to better coexist with the big carnivores, we do teach a course in partnership with the University of Montana. Other than that, it's something that we should probably expand into. Maybe just one more question, because I know it's, you know, midday and y'all. Okay, maybe two. Okay, I see. All right. We'll do them quick, though. Yes, in the back.
The way you described how they made trails and kind of almost bedded down in the corn reminded me of the way gorillas, when they bed down and get together. Do bears, are they normally communicative like that? Or is that just because they found that safe food source, the corn?
Well, you found me out. I'm not a biologist. So I can't really tell you what they normally do. I mean, they definitely congregate much more around big food sources like that. They're generally solitary in the cornfield where they do bed, and they make these incredible, like, I wrote a lot about this. They make these incredible rooms in the corn because they'll knock down these little circles where they're feeding. But when you go in there and the corn is up and arching over you, it's just a bizarre space to be in. It brings them together in ways that they don't often come together in this landscape. You see it more commonly in places where there are big food sources like Alaskan salmon streams, or in some of these high altitude insect colonies that will bring bears together like that.
In your experience, have you seen more use of the conservation easements, more and more ranchers?
So yeah, the question is, have I seen more use of the conservation easement? I'm seeing it more and more. It's a hard thing. It's tough, right? So Greg Schock, the dairy farmer on whose land most of this story takes place, he's in this really difficult moment right now. He's contemplating subdividing his place, which is incredible grizzly habitat, because he's not had, you know, he hasn't had a day off in 6 months, and he's been working very hard to make ends meet. And when he looks at a conservation easement, he sees that he can't quite get the value out of it that he needs or wants. So it's tough, but I am seeing more people move in that direction. And I think it's an essential tool, because absent that, absent some kind of perpetual restriction on the deed, it's always going to depend on every subsequent owner getting it right. And humans, I just don't believe in our collective restraint that much. So we have to set up situations where we will succeed. Yeah.
What will you write on next?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think it's going to have to do, I mean, I've sort of been making my way through the large carnivores. And all I can say right now is that I think that human beings are my next large carnivore. that's all I know. I'm gonna take a break and then start. Yeah. Was there one more question? Yes.
We seem to be managing for growth instead of coming up with a sustainable tourism management plan or a sustainable building plan. I mean, you know, just take the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, 26 counties, unrestrained growth, interfering with, you know, many, many wildlife corridors, and not looking at the big picture. What would you suggest, and how would we approach something like that to get, you know, an entity to look at the entire ecosystem?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that communication is key between counties, because you know, you can be very effective in your own backyard in agitating and advocating for things like the kind of zoning that will work for both agriculture and wildlife. I mean, those two things can go together very well. So figuring out ways at a scale where it's actually possible, and the county scale is a great one, to create strong and meaningful connections between people who value conservation and wildlands and people who value an agricultural way of life, that's a profound block. If you can bring those two people, those two demographics together, that's strength. And that's a place to move from. And then, you know, what I've noticed since I've been involved in conservation is that, you know, we have watershed groups, right? So, you know, the Blackfoot Challenge, Madison Valley Ranchlands group, you have these groups that come together in different communities. And the more that those groups can communicate and coordinate with each other, the better. So there are people out there working on this. They just need to continue to be connected, and they need to be supported by people with their votes, you know, with their donations, all of that stuff. I really appreciate all of you coming, and I appreciate the good questions. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening.
You have just heard a reading recorded on April 27th, 2019 at the Country Bookshelf by award-winning Montana author, rancher, and conservationist Bryce Andrews, whose latest book is Down from the Mountain. To find out more about the work Bryce Andrews does as the field director of People and Carnivores, you can go to their website, peopleandcarnivores.org. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for KGVM-FM, Gallatin Valley Community Radio. It is archived at kgvm.org. We thank you for listening and for supporting your community radio station, KGVM Bozeman.